you know, to go to the NEA and say these people have not been shown, or this body of work has not been seen in California, these artists have not had one-man shows in California, it's pretty hard to turn down. And I wouldn't be able to do this today.
Well, you had
this isn't something that could be replicated. The other thing was, when I found that I was having to teach Cal Gross's class, and my students were having to learn about these people in slides only, mm-hmm. I thought that was ludicrous when it was possible for them to be here. And the same was true at Irvine. I mean, Roy had a show at Irvine. That is not true, because I said Roy hadn't had a one-man show out here, and he had. John Copeland did a show at Irvine about a year before I came. But that particular body of work I showed had never been shown out here. And so it was one of two things. It was either the artist had never had a one-man show out here, or the body of work being shown had never been seen out here. The third criteria was we didn't show anything that students would have access to in a regular gallery in LA, because I didn't see any point in utilizing scarce resources for something you could send a student off to see a short trip in a car.
Did you get pretty good support from the university administration? As Steve Horn was here at that time, was he not? Or?
After the first, let's say half dozen years, yes, because I'd have to go back and look at exact dates as to when his real interest and support kicked in. My guess, mid to late 70s,
mm-hmm.
76, 78, somewhere around in there, and with the primary support being in the 80s, I mean, the biggest support. But it happened not so much because we sought him out, but because he was very active. He was on the Civil Rights Commission, on a number of government commissions that kept him traveling, and when he traveled, people would say things to him, like, I've never been to university and I don't know anything about it, but I'm acquainted with your university art museum.
Mm-hmm.
And he quickly perceived that
we were getting a national reputation.
A very good tool for public relations for the university and recruiting and that sort of thing. And he wanted to support that and did,
mm-hmm.
To his detriment and ours.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it eventually came back to bite him.
In what way?
Well, they used the museum to hang him when they were ready.
Oh, you mean
when his foes were ready. They used his support for the museum and for the arts and the building that he was planning to build for us by Peter Eisenman as a way to force him out.
Was it primarily around the building, or was it around the programming? Was it around building an ambitious building by a major architect, or was it?
It wasn't any of the above. It was that Steve was not what the faculty called a collegial president. He was an autocratic ruler, and he made this university from the funky place it was when I came,
right,
into a very, very fine university by the mid-80s.
Right.
The change that I observed in the quality of students here was quite dramatic, and he willed it into being the way you and I both know creative, ambitious people will things into being, whether it looks possible or not.
Mm-hmm.
But in so doing, he didn't stop to consult with every fool along the way, and it was a period in the history of academic politics when collegiality was the big word, and if you didn't consult with the entire faculty every time you crossed the street, you were and obviously he favored programs. There's no question,
mm-hmm.
that he favored particular programs. And some very strong faculty members began to coalesce in an effort to get rid of a president that didn't favor their programs. And when they were strong enough to force him out, they used the programs that he had championed to hang him with, primarily in the local newspaper. It was partly because it was concurrent with the decline in funding for education. Nobody bothered to talk about money being spent on art in the early 80s and the late 70s when money in education was fairly flush.
Right.